But first, to Detroit. Mayor Dave Bing says tomorrow is the day when Governor Snyder announces whether Detroit needs an emergency manager. Mayor Bing says he spoke with Snyder today, and he would go no further than saying an announcement comes tomorrow. It was just last week that a state-appointed financial review team delivered the news to Governor Snyder. Detroit is in a state of financial emergency, and the city's current leaders lack a plan to deal with it. Here's State Treasurer Andy Dillon speaking last week.
Obviously, the cash condition that the city finds itself in has been a strain on the city. If you look, the city's been running deficits really every year since 2005, and I think I can stand here in confidence and say we gave the city every chance to avoid the outcome that we're recommending to the governor today.
Now, joining us, as he does most weeks, is Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So, the governor could or could decide not to appoint an emergency manager. What are his different options, and what do you think is most likely?
Well, I think his different options are really two. One is that he does go ahead and appoint an emergency manager, or two is he uses the what is now a very clear threat of that to push for a much stiffer and much more, draconian consent agreement with city council and the mayor. The governor right now has maximum leverage in that sense, but I also think he has minimum confidence in the city political leadership to actually deliver on whatever they promise. I mean, they had signed a consent agreement back in April of last year, and it's only been in the last month or two that they've really started to show some progress. So there was a lot of slow walking and dissembling, and I don't think he has much confidence that if he does do a revised consent agreement, that they would actually live up to it. Therefore, I think it's highly likely that we could see an emergency manager appointed fairly soon. Could be imminent. I don't think we exact know, but I would not be surprised to see it happen very soon.
Now, we have heard a little internal buzz, and I wonder if you have as well, that the governor is actually having a hard time finding someone to take the job. Have you mm-hmm. caught that wind as well?
Yeah, I think that's been our sense, and I think that's one of the reasons he's waiting, because he wants to be able to do whatever he does. He wants to be able to do it very emphatically, to be standing next to that person, and probably in Detroit, so that person who has the credentials, both financially and managerially, both in the public and the private sector, but particularly in the public sector, of doing something like this. Yeah, I think it is a tough sell. I don't think it's going to be an insider. I don't think it's going to be a Detroiter known to Detroiters. I think it's going to be somebody from the outside, because I think to some extent you're seeing the old guard really raising itself up in the last week and saying, we don't want an emergency manager. It's not right. But those are all the people that were kind of have been part of the problem managerially. And it reminds me a lot of General Motors in late 2008 and 2009, where you had a lot of essentially GM lifers who'd been running the company and risen to the top saying, we can do this on our own. And ultimately, the President of the United States and his automotive task force came to the conclusion they didn't think they could.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are four-plus years later, where you have two companies that went into bankruptcy are now led by outsiders and are doing far better and have a much more competitive business model than they had in 2008.
Speaking, as we did a few moments ago, about Detroit City Council, there is one report that the council is being advised to look toward another consent agreement with the state, mm-hmm. something, as we know, that's already been tried. Is this just more of the same from council as far as dragging their feet? And, you know, that can only get kicked so far down the road.
Well, that's right. It can get only kicked so far down the road, but I think there's really two things at work here. One is there's a very real sense about the democratic process and a perversion of the democratic process, and that's what the emergency manager represents.
Yes.
The other thing I think we have to be very honest about is that these are elected politicians who are trying to preserve their power and, to some extent, their paychecks. And I think the fear is that if an emergency manager is appointed, that it won't be very long before they are rendered politically obsolete and potentially have a goodly chunk, if not all, of their compensation stripped from them. That's a possibility. I wouldn't say it's certain, but I think they assume that at least a political neutering is likely to happen. So that's what is, I think, driving them to some extent, and also the more overarching issues of democratic government. The final thing I would say is that, you know, the record of emergency managers in Michigan is clearly mixed.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into cities somewhat much smaller than Detroit, school systems, none of these have emerged perfectly clean. There have been troubles. There have been some real impacts on services, and the issues in Detroit are, at a matter of scale, much bigger than anything we've seen thus far. And the other monkey wrench in all of this is the coming election. You've got people that are going to be running for mayor. Who are they going to get elected to a job that has no power? I mean, I think we really don't know what that's going to look like. And I think the extent to which an emergency manager stays in place, if one is appointed, is going to have a lot to do with who's elected mayor in November.
Speaking of that, I'd like to get your thoughts on Mike Duggan having thrown his hat in the ring. And, of course, he wrote that op-ed in the Free Press last weekend saying An emergency manager is not the right way to go for Detroit. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, Mike does have a demonstrated record of turnarounds both in the public and private sector, and I think that is very significant. And from my own view, some of the people who are also putting their hat in the ring are on the verge of doing so. He's clearly head and shoulders above them in that respect. And I'm just talking about the technical aspects of turnaround.
Yes.
I think he's got a pretty good handle on what some of the issues are. He understands issues of liability, legacy liabilities. He's negotiated concessionary contracts with unions. He knows how to work with the financial community in a way that a lot of people in the public sector basically do not. So I think he probably will emerge as a very viable candidate. Because I get a sense that things in Detroit, we're a real inflection point. I'm at a conference today where they're talking about what's going on in Detroit, and the sense of energy and positiveness is palpable. And I don't think anybody is afraid of an emergency manager. I think what people are looking at this and saying, look, the private sector is moving, things are happening, and whatever comes out of an emergency manager can only be positive for the city.
Well, in a sense that it's nowhere to go but up, right?
Yeah. I mean, you really have a tale of several Detroits here. I mean, you have an auto industry that is making more money, is more successful than it's been in any of our lifetimes in a lot of ways. You have a private sector that is investing its own capital in the city, bringing more jobs, rehabbing buildings, creating a sense of energy. And then you have financial problems at the city, which is... and operational problems, which have been building for a very long time and have finally reached a critical stage. We've seen this before. These things can get worked out. There are ways to negotiate. A lot of what an emergency manager would do is negotiations with creditors, with unions, with reorganizing or helping to reorganize the city departments, consolidate, sell them off. There's all sorts of different ways to look at it, but I think net-net the feeling in the business community is, let's get moving with this. This is probably a good thing. Now, they're not the ones that are going to potentially lose their jobs, but I think they think that it might get the city on a more sound footing.
Daniel Howes, business columnist for the Detroit News. Always good talking with you, Daniel. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a big, big disconnect happening in Michigan, and it's happening with the state's 670,000 military veterans. Let's cut right to the chase. Michigan has the 11th highest population of veterans in the nation. But when it comes to federal money spent per vet on all the services that veterans are entitled to, and that includes employment assistance and medical treatment, Michigan is dead last, 53rd on the list. After Guam. Now, the benefits and the assistance are there, so we need to find out why aren't Michigan's veterans getting what's due to them. We're going to explore this question with the Senior Deputy Director for Veterans Affairs for Michigan's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Jason Allen, joining me in the studio. Welcome to Stateside, Jason.
Thank you so much. It's very much a privilege to be here today.
So go back into 2011 when Governor Snyder's quote was, "The way our vets are treated in the state was unacceptable." Why is it that the assistance and benefits are not trickling down to the vets the way they are in other states? And
it's a couple different areas.
Yeah.
Number one is that we have not integrated veterans assistance into so many different areas of society. Second thing is awareness. And then finally, it is sometimes very prideful. A lot of these men and women don't want to use the benefits. The aspect of what we're trying to attempt to do is whether you're dealing with folks in the homeless community, whether you're dealing with folks in the legal side and the courts and those types of systems. Also then within the public health area, then from there going into our prisons. What types of changes in entry are we asking? Are you a veteran? Because so many of the sort of catchment basins for our less fortunate have not thought through this process. And we have great partners out there, but it's taken time, whether you're working with the 211 system, whether you're working with our local senior citizen meal sites, to ask the question, did your husband, are you a member, have you served, to bring those resources in.
So literally, it's right at the point of entry.
Right. So many other states, and this is where the governor has been impassioned about this, is restructuring some of our basic questions. The next area is sort of the awareness, and I've had the privilege of working with a variety of state legislators. I did last year almost 30 veterans town hall meetings from Monroe to Iron Mountain, and veterans are not aware of those benefits. And then finally, you start sitting down and talking to men and women that served, and they think, well, I wasn't in combat, so I didn't earn these. I was not in a tough situation. Those are dollars that are available to other men and women.
And so they don't see themselves as deserving, but they are they are just as deserving.
Right. And so let's kind of go through the sort of the big three areas of benefits. And then I want to talk a little bit as we conclude about the Michigan Veterans Trust Fund, which is another area that men and women don't utilize. The first area is the young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And when you look at the aspect of the utilization of the GI Bill, Michigan really needs to do a better job, and we're working with our college partners. But when a person comes back, they qualify for about eight semesters, so that'd be 4 years of college, and that's portable to your children or to your spouse.
Did not know that. We certainly saw the World War II generation took advantage of that.
And so our best college using the GI Bill kind of fluctuates, but right now it's Lansing Community College. And we have the 11th largest veterans population, but Lansing Community College is number 221 out of all colleges and universities. And so we've got to retool our education system, and then we go from there to the healthcare benefits. And so many of our men and women coming back qualify for 5 years free healthcare. On top of that, so statistically, as you know, in the Civil War, 48% of all men served in the Civil War in the state of Michigan, and we were a Lincoln land-grant state.
Okay.
And for every death, there was one survivor. In the Second War, about 25% of the population served in the Second War, and for every death, there were two survivors. This conflict, it's about 3% of society in the military, but for every death, there are 27, 28 survivors.
So the whole balance is different.
Correct. And so what we are seeing is that we're seeing a much higher percentage of men and women coming back with because of the time in combat. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 days in the Civil War, about 60 to 90 days in World War II in combat. Now, that doesn't mean getting back and forth or being on the base. Mm-hmm. And then this, you know, we've got multiple deployments for a year at a time. And so many of our men and women aren't signing up for the disability ratings, much because of the issues we talked about. And then there are additional tax credits available for hiring veterans. And so that's one large segment. The next big segment that we're working diligently on, and we've gotten great support, but it's just getting the system in place, is our Vietnam-era veterans. And exposure to dioxins, you know, the situation would, if you have diabetes, cancer, ALS, systemic heart disease, so many of those automatically are what they call presumptive pre-qualifiers.
So you're
automatic,
in.
Yeah, you're in.
You're in.
And then the final area is that we're underperforming is with our mature veterans. And this is what we talked about with our senior citizens, is what they call aid and attendance and widow's pensions.
So our Korean and
World War II
vets.
Right.
Yes.
And so those are another very robust program, a little bit more complicated. But they are qualifiers. And so as your family caregivers and providers, this is an area. It takes some time to get that paperwork filled out, but we're significantly underperforming there.
We're speaking with Jason Allen. He's the Senior Deputy Director for Veterans Affairs for Michigan's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and really trying to crack the question, how do we get the benefits they're due to the veterans of Michigan? And if a veteran or a family member is listening to us right now, and they're wondering, what kinds of services and benefits are we talking about? What are they entitled to?
Okay, so the first area that I would suggest from a schooling perspective, if you have the time to get on the internet, and I recognize that you broadcast throughout the state, and some places don't have that, the VA website and the michigan.gov/VA is a good place. The next area is that we have a very diverse set of county programs. And so sometimes maybe you're in very rural parts of the state, they may not have as robust support as some of our more urban areas. But the county buildings have generally a veterans office that they can sit down and talk with. And one of the areas that we're talking about right now that I wanted to at least ask people to consider on a utilization standpoint is after the Second War, Michiganians set up a trust fund. It's approximately $50 million. And in each county, there's a trust fund office. This is for wartime area veterans. And those veterans, if you're having a problem making your heating payments, if you're having a problem making ends meet, because we know at the end of the heating season, things get tough with families.
Yes.
And so this trust fund, there's an office here in Washtenaw County, and there's one in Alger County. And those grants are available for wartime veterans. So that doesn't mean, if you're at Fort Hood and still at a base, you're a wartime veteran. Served in World War II and didn't get deployed overseas. That's a wartime era veteran. And those are dollars are available for sort of emergencies. And we have several million dollars a year that we are able to distribute through those systems. It's been going on since the Second War.
The pride issue, do you see that in across the board despite the age of the veterans, or do you see that more with the older vets?
It's interesting because if you go back and study history, Washington said something to the effect that we're going to be judged by how we treat our veterans. When we sit down and take a look about Abraham Lincoln, and what Lincoln talked about was taking care of our veterans. It's an important part, and we've got to make sure that they're aware of these opportunities to help the next generation.
Now, the new Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency starts operating on March 20th, which, by the way, is the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq. How will that make a difference?
The first area is that Michigan was one of three states in the Union that weren't certified. So that meant we could not apply for benefits as a state for veterans on their behalf. We were able to get certification that was announced in the State of the Union address – or excuse me, State of the State address in January. That allows us now to have a PIN number, fill out the applications, and work for our veterans. The second component is then we will be upstanding in regards to additional staffing and partners. And this is a team effort, and it's going to require so many different social agencies and a restructuring of our thought process, which will then allow us to at least talk through with these agencies. It's interesting that Ohio, just across the border, is in the top 10 states in the union as far as utilization of benefits. And so we have a very long way ahead of us, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and we're very optimistic.
Jason Allen, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Jason Allen is the Senior Deputy Director for Veterans Affairs for Michigan's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. If you are a creative type, maybe you're in R&D at your company or you're in research at a university, chances are you may have had cause to file for a patent. For anyone seeking a patent, March 16th is a very, very important date. That is the day the United States changes its patent system. And companies and inventors are being urged to kind of step on it, take advantage of the current system before the big change. So we're going to find out what this big change is and whether it might help or hurt businesses, universities, and inventors. Joining me now in the studio, we welcome Bryce Pills, who's an assistant professor in the Entrepreneurship Clinic at the University of Michigan. Bryce, welcome to Stateside.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And also from U of M, Max Stein, who's a professor of material science engineering, and he also teaches innovation at the Entrepreneurship Master's Program. And so, Max, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Good to have you both here. So, Bryce, the big, big change happening March 16th is essentially a change from what's called the first-to-invent system of filing to the first-to-file system. Explain the difference.
So first off, the Act is really broad, and this is just one small component.
And this is the America Invents Act?
The America Invents Act. This is far and away the most expansive revision to our patent laws that we've had since patent laws came into effect 200 years ago. And one aspect of it is this change from a first-to-invent system to a first inventor to file. And basically that gets at what do you look at in figuring out who we're going to award a patent to. So if you have two people that come up with the same idea and they're both seeking a patent on it, under the current system, we are one of the few countries or maybe the only country in the world that said if you're the first to invent, we're going to give the patent to you. It doesn't matter when you filed as long as you didn't delay in seeking to file an application. The rest of the world said as between two people that are inventors, the first to get to the patent office, the first to file the application is going to get the patent, even if you are the second to invent. Many people are concerned that this says, oh, now there's going to be a race and you just need to file a patent application. It's important to note that you still need to be an inventor. It's the first inventor to file. It's not the first person out there to hear of something and run to the patent office and file a patent application.
And this really matters in Southeast Michigan. This recent report by the Brookings Institution finds that Southeast Michigan, especially Ann Arbor and companies in Detroit, are among the top spots in the nation in terms of patents being awarded. How does this all impact us, I guess, just widely? I'll start with you, Bryce.
Well, patents are one metric you can use to show the type of research activity and innovation that's going on in an area. People will apply for patents because it gives you a monopoly. 20 years from the date you file a patent application, you're the only one in the United States that can make you offer to sell that invention if you're awarded a U.S. patent. And we grant that monopoly to someone to incentivize them to come up with these great ideas and also to incentivize them to disclose that idea to the world, because you teach the world how to practice your invention in a patent. Once your monopoly expires, then it's part of the public domain, and we can all learn from that. It's better than everyone keeping their idea secret as a trade secret. And so if people are spending the money it takes to apply for and get these patents, it shows the amount of great creativity in an area, especially in the medical arts and the hard sciences like engineering or Max practices.
Is this a predictor of job growth, Max?
Well, it can be. I would say that what you often see in companies and corporations that file for a lot of patents, it reflects perhaps more on their budget that's allocated toward that rather than their commercial success. You know, the overwhelming majority of patents have very little or no commercial value. Something like 99% of all patents have very, very little commercial value.
Is that the kind of thing like Uncle Marty might have invented up in the attic?
Something along these lines. I mean, there's thousands of patents for mousetraps, and there's only a few that are actually effective. There's patents for devices to screw in light bulbs, all kinds of very, very neat things. With the new law, I'm getting the impression that there's some clauses in there that are going to make it they're going to create an advantage for companies with large budgets to file and prosecute patents. There's kind of a clause in there for challenging patents after they're issued or after they're applied for, but before they're actually granted. And the whole legal process that's involved in doing that, companies with big budgets are going to be able to get through it a lot better. So there are some concerns. Yes, we do have a very large patents per capita figure in this area, probably because of all of the industry that's here, probably because of all of the universities that we have here. We actually have quite a number of very good universities in the state. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing if we're just talking about things statistically. But there are also some thoughts out there emerging more recently as to how do we make these patents and these ideas more effective, and how do we bridge that gap between invention and innovation and commercialization more effectively so that we're not just playing a numbers game just like everybody else. And so that's part of what we've been trying to address actually with a lot of these entrepreneurship programs at universities. And so one way to look at it is that universities now have a civic duty to help with commercializing a lot of the discoveries that they're making. It is taxpayer dollars after all.
And Bryce Pills, I want to have your take on that as we wrap up.
So just one point on the small company versus big company. Max brought up a good point that one other aspect of this new patent reform law is that it's easier to challenge patents that have been issued. And I think that is one area where there's concern that big companies are better equipped to exercise that challenge process, and perhaps that just adds barriers to small companies, because not only do you have to pay a bunch of money to get a patent, but now a big company can challenge it even after you have an issued patent.
Have a lot of money to keep challenging.
And have a lot of money to keep challenging. On the first to invent to first inventor to file change, I actually think that's an area where small companies may be able to take advantage of that better than big companies. Big companies take a long time to make decisions to file patents. Yeah. It needs to go through a first review committee, a second review committee, and then they finally file.
Yes.
Now, they're probably going to change that a little bit. But small companies can be tremendously nimble, and you know, realizing that they have something that's protectable, Working with the patent attorney to file a provisional application, universities like the University of Michigan have become pretty sophisticated in how they use provisionals to get a filing date quickly so people like Max can go out and talk and publish about their inventions. So it'll be interesting to see how people change their behaviors to take advantage of this new system. And on Max's last point, you know, I agree. You know, patents are just one metric. You know, for a long time, there's been a perception and probably a reality that there are a number of bad patents out there. And the patent office was probably not doing as good of a job as it could of both issuing good patents and then making sure it wasn't issuing bad patents. And so one of the important aspects of this bill, I think, is that it makes it easier for the patent office to maintain its fees. Congress can't divert those fees to other uses. And hopefully we're going to have a better funded and better functioning patent office. And one aspect of that is the new patent office we have in Detroit, which is, you know, hopefully going to be able to speed up the examination process and make it easier to get these good ideas to market.
And issue patents that are actually worthwhile instead of the gazillionth mouse trap.
Exactly.
We've been speaking with Matt Stein, who's a professor of material science engineering and teaches innovation at the Entrepreneurship Master's Program at U of M. Max, thank you for joining us. And Bryce Pills, who's a professor in the Entrepreneurship Clinic, also at U of M. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We now take up the topic of charter schools in Michigan, particularly the question, is there an academic difference in charter schools operated by for-profit companies as compared to charters run by nonprofits? That question is the focus of a piece appearing in today's Bridge magazine. Joining the program now is Bridge writer Ron French. Welcome back, Ron.
Thanks.
Good to have you with us. And from Public Sector Consultants, we have the Chief Executive Officer, Jeff Williams, joining us. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
So before we get to the answer that you found to that question, I want to set the stage a little by reviewing just where we stand in terms of charter schools in Michigan. Now, Jeff, Governor Snyder signed a law increasing the number of charter school contracts around the state. So how many do we have today? How many charter schools are in Michigan right now?
As of the start of school this past fall, in fall of 2012, we had 256 charter school districts in the state out of a total of about 861 districts. So they're roughly, you know, they're a third of the overall districts in the state that serve the K-12 population directly.
And where does that put us in comparison to other states?
You know, in terms of other states, we're clearly toward the upper end of the range. Part of the challenge when you compare to other states is there are some states that have more schools, but they're a lot smaller. There are other states that have a fewer number of schools, but the student population in each building is much bigger. So it's always kind of a challenge to figure out where we stack up. We certainly in Michigan are in the top 10, top 11 in the nation, mostly driven by our population. We kind of cheat towards the top five because of the expansion and interest in charter schools, especially in the last 10 years.
And Ron, in your story in Bridge, you note Michigan has the highest proportion of for-profit charter schools in the nation.
That's right. And there's some debate about that because different groups will define for-profit in different ways. But most agree that we have over half of our charter schools are operated by a for-profit company. Some will argue that's closer to three-quarters. One study indicates that more than one-quarter of all the for-profit charter schools in the country are located in Michigan.
So, Ron, you joined with Public Sector Consultants, and you analyzed and crunched data in what way, looking for what?
Well, Cynthia, we had an analysis that looked at how schools ranked by looking at past raw test scores. Because if you just look at raw test scores, you will find that a Bloomfield Hills will always do great and a Detroit will always do poorly. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to look at, take into account the level of poverty at the schools. And because, unfortunately, the poorer students are, the poorer they do on standardized test scores on average. And so we wanted to look at what schools are breaking through that ceiling of expectations. And when we did that, we were able to rank schools. And we found a lot of schools that were in high poverty areas that add a lot of value to the student achievement of the students who go there. So when we had that, so we wanted to then look at how charter schools do, and especially look at how those charter schools do when you break down the schools that are operated by for-profit organizations and those that are broken down by nonprofit, because that's been a debate here for years.
Yes.
And so we wanted to see whether there was a difference.
In fact, there are lawmakers in Lansing who are, you know, trying to work to ban for-profit charter operators.
Absolutely, and you can understand the logic of it. The sense is that, well, if someone is making money on schools, they're going to do everything they can to squeeze pennies here and there, and student achievement is going to could suffer. And so we tried to use our value added matrix and to see how that turned out.
So Jeff Williams from Public Sector Consultants, what was the verdict as all of that data was crunched and you and Ron worked together? What did you find in terms of the academic performance between the for-profit charters and the nonprofits?
Well, two statements stand out. One is, at first glance, when we ran the numbers, there is not a meaningful difference between the performance of for-profit and not-for-profit charter schools. And we saw that across the different grade levels. Now, when we say that, we have to be a little careful as number crunchers and statisticians, because some of the cell sizes, meaning some of the things we have to test, are very small. So we can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt if we were using that standard. But the circumstantial evidence is sure pointing toward no difference observed between how a charter school is managed, for-profit, not-for-profit, or self-managed.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And speaking today with the Chief Executive Officer of Public Sector Consultants, Jeff Williams, and joined by writer Ron French, his piece in today's Bridge, looking at the question, is there an academic difference in charter schools that are operated by for-profit companies versus charters run by nonprofits? So you're finding that academically there really isn't a difference between the two. So then the question comes, where do these charter schools match up with traditional schools? You kind of found them clumped at the ends, didn't you?
We found a mixed bag. You find that some of the best schools in the state are charter schools. You find that a lot of the worst schools in the state are charter schools. The charter schools at the moment tend to clump at the extremes. For example, of the charter schools we looked at, 48% were in the bottom quarter of scoring. Okay, and compared to 22% of traditional districts being in the bottom quarter. So you think, well, that's a problem. But then when you look at the value-added matrix, you see that three of the top five scoring schools in the state were charter schools.
Hmm.
So it seems to me that what you're seeing here is that, just like with a lot of things in life, you know, if you choose carefully, you can find a good one.
Who operates the highest scoring charter schools in Michigan, Ron?
You have to understand that a lot of charter operators don't operate enough schools to really get a good sense.
Okay.
But there was one that stood out, and that's National Heritage Academies. We found that their schools scored much above average and much, much more better than the average charter school. And they are a for-profit organization. In fact, they're a national organization.
Jeff, I'm curious, as you kind of looked at all of this and dug into this, drilled down into this data, what's your thought? What do you think separates a high-performing charter school from a low-performing charter?
Well, and this is where, again, the detail that's in the statistics, while the average between a traditional public school and a charter school, meaning when you lump them all together, there's not much different, it's in that distribution, meaning it's in how they're spread out. So pick any single charter school and its neighboring public school district, and there will be very clear differences in performance. And as Ron said, sometimes we find that the charter schools outperform a traditional public, and sometimes we find the reverse. So just as Ron said, when we're talking about an individual school selection, we can clearly identify in a small number outperformers and underperformers. It's when you start to say within this five-county region or across the state as a whole, because there are just so many institutions, you know, more than 800 districts in the state, things start to clump together.
Hmm.
And I think a thing to add to that is this points out the importance for families of being smart shoppers, of finding out information, as much information as you can about your local public school district as well as the charters in your area, because sometimes there's a difference.
Where is the best place for a parent to shop that information, especially if they're at the beginning with it, with young kids and they're new to placing a child in school? Where would you start shopping that information?
Well, in terms of the very raw numbers, the first place would be myschooldata.org. It's actually a website operated by the Michigan Department of Education. It has kind of dashboard-style reports, or the Joe Friday-style, just basics about, you know, number of teachers, number of children per grade. And it also has that information about the standardized tests, the MEEP and the MyAccess tests. Beyond that, I would look to organizations and analyses like those done by Bridge Magazine. I'd look at Education Trust. There are a number of nonprofits in the state that do very good commentaries on schools and school selection, where that's where you pick up some of the nuance. Like this value-added matrix that Bridge asked us to do, it's one thing just to compare the raw scores of 11th graders on proficiency for college. Mm-hmm. But the value-added matrix adjusts that raw score for the children that are in poverty, because we do know that there are academic differences, sadly, with children in poverty versus not. Children that, you know, get good meals to school, have preparation, have supportive families, tend to outperform. Unless you adjust for that, the raw scores don't tell all of the story. So I'd always encourage folks to start at the Department of Education on that myschooldata.org website and go from there either to Bridge or to EdTrust or to the other institutions that add some more nuance into that story.
Ron French, what is the sense of the takeaway from this piece that you have in Bridge and from the work you've done? What should parents, teachers who would be listening, and lawmakers take away from what you found?
We may need to move away from the debate about profit versus for-profit and look. I don't think the question is really about governance. I think the question is about performance, because you can find good for-profit charters and very bad ones also. You need to look at how these schools are performing, and let's dive in and figure out what's making them work and apply that to all the schools.
Jeff Williams from Public Sector Consultants and Bridge Senior Writer Ron French, thank you so much today for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you think of shipwrecks and the Great Lakes, chances are, thanks to Gordon Lightfoot, the Edmund Fitzgerald is the first one to come to mind. But there are thousands of ships that have been swallowed up by the Great Lakes. Tony Gramer is a diver and an award-winning underwater photographer, and he knows of other famous ships that have been taken by the Great Lakes. He's presenting the story behind one of these wrecks at the 32nd Great Lakes Shipwreck Festival, happening this weekend at Washtenaw Community College. Tony Gramer joins us in the studio. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Well, you've been diving since 1977. What drew you to become such an expert and so involved with shipwrecks?
Well, actually, I started out after some injuries playing sports with my knees. I ended up starting diving in 1977. And Mike Nelson, the Sea Hunt.
Of course, Lloyd Bridges.
Absolutely. That
the
got
old
me
show.
Involved.
For those who are not baby boomers, it was a hit show in the 60s, the early 60s, yes.
Absolutely. And one of the things that intrigues me about the shipwrecks, it's our history. When you go down, it's a time capsule. And it captures everything from the past and the way they built the ships, the types of ships they are, if they're a schooner, or if they're a brig, if they're a freighter, a tugboat. It's just fascinating to dive back into history and to see those things underwater.
What is that like? Is you're down there and you're right. You're actually going to be talking at the festival about the Anna Dobbins that sunk in Saginaw Bay in 1886. What kind of thoughts are going through your mind as you're down there exploring?
Well, the first time that you dive a shipwreck, if you happen to find one, the first thing that you do is you kind of study. I take a lot of pictures, I do film now, video, as opposed to still photography. And I do research on the shipwrecks. I go downtown to the main library downtown, mm-hmm. do research, Bowling Green University. So you do all the research, and then you know what you're actually diving. Once you find it, you say, oh, yeah, this is a tug. This was Anna Dobbins. It was the fastest tug in the Great Lakes. It had 292 horsepower back in 1862. So it was the fastest tug. Normally, a tug would have roughly 50 horsepower. This one had 292 horsepower, and it actually that's what actually caused it to sink because it had too much horsepower, and the shaft broke and allowed water to come in while it was towing four ships.
Ooh, so she was almost too big and strong for her own good.
That's exactly right.
What is it, do you think, Tony, about shipwrecks, hearing the stories that grabs the public? I mean, whether it's Titanic, which was an enormous, enormous hit, and certainly used James Cameron's exploration video very, very effectively, or the Edmund Fitzgerald. What is it about the shipwreck story that grabs us?
What grabs me is the history of the shipwreck. Give an example. A lot of the shipwrecks from the 18th century, a lot of the designs came from Europe. So it reminded me of the old pirate ships. And that really intrigues me because, you know, people think gold, things like that, they're on these ships. Well, not so much gold, but the old artifacts such as dishes and silverware and things like that, maybe some personal items from people, some shoes and items like that. When you look at all that stuff, that's our history. Mm-hmm. When you look back at – when you go to a museum, for instance, like Dawson's Museum downtown, mm-hmm. when you walk through there, you see all these old artifacts. Well, those artifacts came from somewhere. Well, they came from some of the shipwrecks here in the Great Lakes. There's like 10,000 shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and only 3,500 of them have been located.
So there's plenty for an
explorer. So there's a lot out
there,
but it's like a needle in a haystack. We search for hours and hours and hours to try to find a shipwreck. We do a lot of research and trying to try to find a shipwreck, and it's very challenging. It's just like Ballard when they found the Titanic. They did a lot of research to find a Titanic. It's the same thing here in the Great Lakes. One of the ones that the Edmund Fitzgerald, for instance. Mm-hmm. We know approximately where it went down when it went down, and that but they actually had to search for it to find it.
Okay, because?
Well, there was 29 crewmen that died on that ship, and they wanted to find out why it went down, how it went down. And that's one of the things that we like to do when we find a shipwreck. We like to document it, and I have marine artist Bob McGreevy do a lot of my drawings for me. So he'll look at my video and take a look, and he'll actually do the drawings of it. And what we're trying to do is detail out the drawing and kind of have people look at it, and I can explain how the ship went down just by the way it lies down there on the bottom. Well, you know what went down bow first, maybe listening towards the port side or something like that. So there's a lot of things that you can look at to identify a shipwreck.
Well, clearly it's a popular subject with the public because this is the 32nd Great Lakes Shipwreck Festival, and it's being put on by the Ford Seahorses Scuba Diving Club along with the Dawson Great Lakes Museum and the Detroit Historical Society, and it's happening this weekend at Washtenaw Community College. You can get details at shipwreckfestival.org, and we've been talking with one of the presenters, award-winning underwater photographer and master diver Tony Gramer. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.